Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate welcomes Mark Burford to discuss his book, Mahalia Jackson and the Black Gospel Field. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Mark Burford, the author of Mahalia Jackson and the Black Gospel Field. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
Yeah, and I just want to say, first up, for all my readers, especially those who don't consider themselves gospel fans or whatever, this book is the most Let It Roll book I have read in years. It covers everything, and in depth. It's got the broader political context. It's got the life story. It's got some musical analysis. It's got the business analysis, both the live recording, TV, radio, publishing. It's got it all. So Mark, hats off on a really, really great scholarly book on Mahalia Jackson.
And Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sure. And I want to get you start out pretty bold, I think, in the preface. And you say the most fundamental questions can be the most fruitful. And then you boil it down to why her? Why was Mahalia? And presumably the implication is that why was Mahalia Jackson the face of not just gospel, but I would almost argue African-American music and maybe even African-American culture for a period in the 1950s and 1960s. She was the face of a people in a way to the mass American audience that watched CBS, that listened to Ed Sullivan on the radio, that watched him on TV on Sunday nights. Is that, am I misstating the question? And can you try to answer it for us?
No, I don't think you're mistaken at all. And I think it continues in a lot of ways. I think it's very telling that, you know, one thing I noticed in doing research for the book, that there have been at least 7 musicals about Mahalia Jackson's life. There have been all kinds of tributes. There are 2 biopics that have come out within the last couple years. So her life and career is something that not just African Americans, but broader American culture continues to return to over and over again. And I think it's, you know, the contours of her life as a granddaughter of enslaved African Americans who migrated from New Orleans to Chicago, a kind of quintessential American story. But I think for African Americans in particular, she has such cultural relevance. I think it's the sound of her voice. I think it's the time when her career kind of began in that kind of interwar and war period. I think it's what her recordings represented in terms of a kind of coming out for Black vernacular culture, a kind of gospel music, which tends to be under the radar screen. And I think it's also her civil rights commitments that she was, her pride as an African American and her willingness to kind of put her fame and celebrity, put her thumb on the scale in terms of the civil rights movement, in terms of her celebrity and artistic status. So I think there are a lot of reasons why she became the face of gospel, but also a kind of cultural icon for African Americans.
And that's very hard to argue with. And you start the book out by focusing in on one moment when she was a guest on Ed Sullivan's Talk of the Town. And for those of us who are living in the 21st century and don't know, Ed Sullivan was a big deal. He's more than just the guy who introduced the Beatles. He was the host of the most popular television show in America for essentially 15 years, maybe even a little bit longer than that. But Ed Sullivan was somebody who it wasn't just random that he picked Mahalia Jackson to feature on his show. He had an agenda. What was that agenda?
Well, I think Ed Sullivan, one thing that people don't know about him is that he was very purposeful in programming African Americans on his show. From his very first show, he would program popular artists. So the fact that he had Mahalia Jackson on the show was telling of his commitments, and African Americans recognized that. In fact, in one newspaper report, they said that he kind of gave her too brief and too brusque an introduction, but that he had a little bit of credit because he had had treated African Americans so well. So for that showcase, I mean, that was the most popular show in the United States, and that was really, I think, a coming out moment for Black gospel, for Mahalia Jackson certainly, but it was an introduction in some ways of Black gospel to the American public at large.
And people hate when I do this, but I'm going to read a block of text from your book at you, because you say that the moment that she's appearing on Ed Sullivan raises a bounty of issues that help illuminate post-war gospel. And I want to just run through them real quickly to give people an idea of the scope of your book, because your book really deals with every single one of these things and really well. First up, the production and circulation of gospel repertoire, the documentation of gospel music on record, gospel's various ensembles and performance approaches, how biblical scripture becomes gospel song, and how through performance this shared repertory becomes personal testimony. Also, the professional aspirations of gospel singers, the reception of gospel singing by African Americans beyond the context of the Black church, questions of race, representation, and mediation, and the salience of both collective protests and individual prestige in the Black freedom struggle, and not least, the place of U.S. popular culture within, not in opposition to, the Black gospel music field. So I just wanted to run through that litany because you tackle all these issues and so well. But I'm going to ask you to tackle and unpack a shorter sentence, because you sum up Mahalia Jackson, and in particular, four things about her that I think readers need to understand. And that is this sentence: the 40-year-old Jackson, this is at the time of the show, a Baptist born and bred, but Pentecostal friendly Chicago resident, originally from New Orleans. Unpack that recipe. What are the ingredients here that make Mahalia Jackson the queen of gospel?
Well, I think what's interesting about Jackson is that there's a lot of fluidity. And so in some ways, she's the kind of marrow of the bone of Black musical history for a lot of people, that she represents a kind of a core element of Black cultural identity. But what's interesting about her is that she constantly negotiated, had a kind of fluidity in the way she negotiated various positions. So she always identified strongly as being from New Orleans and being a Southerner in that sense. And yet Chicago was her home, and it was her base for the majority of her life. So I think negotiating that North-South, I wouldn't say divide, but certainly dichotomy. And when she came to Chicago, she was under some pressure in some ways and a criticism for bringing some of that kind of Southern blues sensibility to kind of Northern Black mainline churches. She also negotiated religiously in New Orleans. She was Baptist and very much in the bosom of the Baptist church, but she also had a Pentecostal church down the street, and the worship style of Pentecostal holiness churches tends to be more ecstatic and exuberant. They use instruments in the church. So she was going to the Baptist church, but she was also kind of on the side going to this Pentecostal church. So I think her style of performance reflects her just being deeply immersed in the Baptist church, but also bringing those more exuberant performance styles to her music as well, too, which was at first criticized, but eventually became her bread and butter, and she was embraced for it. I think also the thing that really fascinated me, too, is her her nimbleness in negotiating in Chicago, kind of being a church singer throughout the week, but then also shuttling to the downtown Chicago and showing up on the radio show and the TV show. So she really is working two different audiences, this kind of general kind of mainstream white audience, but also her Black church base. And I think the amount of labor that went into kind of making all of those negotiations can get lost with the kind of the easy description of the queen of gospel music, because I think that involved a lot of negotiation on her part and was part of her mastery as an artist and a public figure.
And I want to introduce our first song, but first I want to apologize. Steph let me know that I was shushing my dog, and I thought I had my mic muted, and that sounded like I was shushing you. So that was anything but my intention. I was trying to prevent my dog from drowning us all out with a barrage of barking.
That's the amen corner coming from your dog. That's all right.
That's right. The call and response. But here's Mahalia Jackson. This is from the Decca Sessions in the 1930s. God's going to separate the wheat from the tares. From Mahalia Jackson's 1937 very brief run on Decca Records, working with the great A&R man Jay Mayo Inc. Williams, and that was God's Gonna Separate the Wheat from the Tares. And this whole Pentecostal, I don't want to say versus Baptist, but there was definitely a rivalry between the more mainline African American religions, the Baptists, the Methodists, the AME, and the Pentecostals. And you know, the more I've learned about this in the process of doing this show and the Holy Roll series with Garrett Cash in particular, there was some real thought and effort going into this on the part of, I don't know if it was the leaders of the Baptist Church, but the musical leaders, some of the musical leaders of the Black Baptist Church, realized they had to compete musically with the Pentecostals, because you know, you had people like Sister Rosetta Tharpe or Arizona Drains performing in a church down the street. You're going to lose a lot of walk-up traffic to those guys. And the sort of Jubilee respectability movement in the 19th century had reached a point where it had kind of lost some of its initial energy. There wasn't any more novelty in seeing, you know, I mean, what was so powerful in the aftermath of the Civil War of seeing African Americans standing tall and performing with grace and performing not only African American spirituals, but, you know, selections from the Western classical playbook. And I don't know, it's just this massive moment. And people like Thomas A. Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson were, I don't want to say stealing the fire like Prometheus, but they were taking some of that zest and charge from the Pentecostal service and bringing it into the Baptist thing. And the other factor, though, the other ingredient in this recipe is that Mahalia Jackson grew up listening to Bessie Smith. She's a massive Bessie Smith fan. How did that impact her music? And what do you, is it even possible to disentangle what she got from the Pentecostals, what she got from the Baptists, and what she got from Bessie Smith?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it is, actually. I mean, one thing about Mahalia Jackson that really came through in my research is that she really had big ears, by which I mean that she really listened carefully and took in sound and had a real keen attentiveness to sound. So I think she could listen to the go to the Pentecostal church and think about the way they sang, the way they perform, the kinds of vocal inflections that she could draw from there. But she also listened to records a lot and had kind of a phonographic education. So she listened to opera singers. She talked about listening to Grace Moore and Lawrence Tibbett, who were white metropolitan opera singers. She listened to Roland Hayes and Paul Robeson and Marian Anderson on recordings as well, too, and really studied them, she said, to get diction and breathing a technique and that sort of thing. But of course, she said her main teacher was Bessie Smith, and she really describes listening to one record in particular, Careless Love Blues, a 1925 recording by Bessie Smith, and just listening over and over and over again. And it's not unlike a lot of musicians. You hear other gospel musicians talking about listening to records to kind of master the nuances of admired singers or jazz musicians, or even, you know, rock and roll musicians wearing out their copy of Johnny B. Goode. But she listened carefully to that record. And she talked about, from Bessie Smith, getting the tone, just the kind of quality of the sound of her voice, and I hear that a lot when on her kind of sustained notes and use of vibrato and those sorts of things on her recordings. She also talked about getting influences from unexpected places, from street vendors, from listening to preachers, to listening to people who she lived right near the Mississippi River, so going to the docks and hearing dock workers sing. So she really was an eclectic singer, and I think that's one thing that made her voice certainly distinctive at the time, her voice and her performance style distinctive at the time, and made her receptive both to Pentecostal listeners, but also to Baptist church listeners as well, too.
And I've mentioned Thomas A. Dorsey, and we've done a whole episode on him and talked a little bit about how Mahalia was one of several front people that and singers that he partnered with to popularize his music. So I kind of want to skip over that a little bit and talk about her brief relationship with Decca and Mayo Inc. Williams. And why did she only cut so few sides and walk away? I mean, it was very rare for African-American artists to get an opportunity to record in 1937, you know, in the aftermath of the Depression still going on, but the record industry had collapsed between 29 and 32. What didn't work with her and Inc.?
I think it was less a matter of her and Inc. Williams than it was that, you know, the records didn't sell. And I think it's important, you know, for context to remember that, you know, Black religious recordings weren't exactly an expected enterprise at the time, the way they were to become. Now, there had been earlier recordings by gospel quartets that go back to the 20s. The Pace Jubilee Singers were a Baptist group led by Hattie Parker. They were recording in the late 20s. Sister Rosetta Tharpe did had some in the later 30s. Had some recordings that sold well, but she was also blending it with jazz singing and Lucky Millinder's singing with Lucky Millinder's band. But I think the kind of just basic kind of church singing, Black church singing on record was not really known quite yet. So in some ways she was ahead of her time, so ahead of her time that after she made those recordings in 1937, just those four sides, she didn't record again for another 9 years. So think about that for a second, that we have Mahalia Jackson on record in 1937, and between 1937 and 1946, we have no record of her voice. It's kind of tantalizing to think about what she sounded like in that near decade of time. But I think it was also Mahalia Jackson's, I think Williams invited her to sing blues and said, you know what, these records didn't sell, but we love your voice. Why don't you sing some blues? And she refused to do that. So I think there was a kind of, you know, honestly, a kind of expectation that Black church singers or Black singers would cross over. If they crossed over, they would cross over to blues and rhythm and blues. She didn't do that. Later on, she sang at the Newport Jazz Festival, but it really wasn't until the later 40s when Move On Up a Little Higher broke that that really persuaded gospel singers that that they can sing like they said. Haley Jackson said that you could sing like you sing in the church, put it on record, and people will actually buy it. So it took a little time for that to become a reality.
And that's a perfect setup for our next song, which is Mahalia Jackson's massive hit on Apollo Records, Move On Up a Little Higher. That was Mahalia Jackson's Move On Up a Little Higher, a million selling record in the late 1940s. I mean, massive, massive, massive hit from a small label, Apollo Records. And yeah, like what you're saying about Mahalia not recording between 1937 and 1946, it's just add another musical history grievance to my list. You know, we don't get Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie perfecting bebop. We barely get to hear Charlie Christian before he passes away. You know, we don't hear Bill Monroe formulating bluegrass. We just get these things emerging fully formed. And Mahalia is kind of the same way. We hear a tiny tease of sort of an embryonic Mahalia, and then boom, she's there fully formed and massively successful. How on earth did a record on Apollo Records, I mean, Ike and Bess Berman's boutique label coming out of New York, how did they move that many units?
Well, they really struggled to. I think they were blindsided by the success of the record. Haley Jackson described going down and picking up boxes of records herself to help distribute them on the South Side. Yeah, and you know, I think that, you know, I mean, it was a successful label, Apollo Records, but certainly it became in some ways the house that Mahalia built because of that record. And the success of that record and her subsequent records for Apollo also laid the foundation for a larger label like Columbia Records getting interested and eventually stealing her away from Apollo.
And I need to backtrack a little bit. I couldn't resist when you introduced the song to jump ahead, but there were some events and there was a particular promoter that she worked with in New York City that possibly played a role in bringing her to the attention of Apollo Records. Who was Johnny Myers and how was he promoting artists like Mahalia and Rosetta Tharpe, and how did that build their momentum in the eastern cities of the U.S.?
Well, Johnny Myers is a really interesting and kind of shadowy figure. He was an African-American promoter, and he was particularly and uniquely interested in Black religious music. So he's also a reminder of how musical traditions, in some ways, in order for us to study musical traditions and musical styles that precede us, we have to rely on recordings. So as you mentioned before, sometimes the absence of those recordings are frustrating to people who write history because we feel like we need to know what the music sounded like. But Myers' work in promoting these mega gospel programs is a reminder of how much gospel was predicated on live performance. So he was putting on these enormous shows, primarily in Harlem, but also in Brooklyn, in Queens, all around in New Jersey, all around the New York metropolitan area. And he would have these huge crowds, But he brought in Mahalia Jackson, and she was just an enormous hit. So in some ways, he's responsible for introducing Mahalia Jackson to the New York region, which is how Apollo Records and various other people encountered her, by singing at these Johnny Myers programs, which were often broadcast on the radio as well, too. So he is in some ways the prototype of the gospel promoter that became more popular later with shows at Madison Square Garden and Carnegie Hall and those sorts of things. So he was doing that uptown in Harlem. But that was a really important phase of her career because it was right after her record broke. And he kind of broadened her visibility beyond Chicago and to the important New York area where the music industry was focused.
And relatively quickly, she's working with a different promoter, Joe Bostick, and is featured on the stage of Carnegie Hall, which was a monumental event. I mean, Carnegie Hall has this totemic cultural power in New York. Explain a little bit about that, how that happened, and what kind of impact it had.
Well, Bostick was actually a protege of Johnny Myers. So he was learning, he got the idea from Johnny Myers, like, wow, gospel could sell and people will show up. If we can do this up in Harlem, maybe we can do this downtown at Carnegie Hall. So he kind of broke away from Johnny Myers and put on a concert at Carnegie Hall. That was a huge deal for Mahalia Jackson too. She was very nervous. She listened to classical. I mean, New Orleans is a town where classical music just kind of circulates and opera singing circulates in unexpected places. So she knew some of the figures who had sung at Carnegie Hall. So she was nervous and felt, you know, what am I doing here and that sort of thing, but was enormously successful. And Bostick played a key role in presenting her in some of those major New York venues. And that was an opportunity, one of the first opportunities for white audiences to hear her in person as well, too.
And let's go ahead and take a sponsor break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the great W. Herbert Brewster, who wrote Move On Up a Little Higher and also, you know, wrote massive hits for the Ward Singers and others. And I want to talk about the Apollo Records relationship to Black songwriters and publishing rights.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So W. Herbert Brewster is kind of the missing ingredient here. The songwriter of Move On Up a Little Higher, he also wrote Surely God Is Able, which does pretty close to the same numbers in 1950 for the Ward Singers. And he's part of a whole generation, you know, kind of following in the wake of Thomas A. Dorsey and others that are writing new gospel songs in the African-American church tradition. But what was Bess Berman's practice like vis-a-vis publishing, especially those written by active American African-American songwriters like Thomas A. Dorsey, who are alive now? I mean, it seems like Mahalia Jackson's name found its way onto a lot of songwriting credits on Apollo Records that probably it shouldn't have.
Well, it's a really interesting question, and it's complicated. In some ways, it's simple. In some ways, it's complicated. I think that it's the practice of not reliably paying Black gospel songwriters is grounded in the belief that Black culture somehow kind of is its own generator, in a sense, that Black religious song just kind of comes from the ether and just kind of emerges from a people. These kinds of ways in which Black music is written about, that is in some ways celebratory. You know, the idea that these musical traditions come out of the Black experience, come out of Black vernacular traditions, are generated by Black culture, which in some ways is a positive thing to celebrate, but it also obscures the fact that sometimes music is actually written by people. So a lot of songs that were sometimes written by actual songwriters were, the label would put, they would put traditional, as if it was a spiritual, for instance. Spirituals are kind of more anonymously written, but gospel songs are not. They have actual songwriters. So there was a tendency to have Bess Berman would sometimes put Mahalia Jackson's name instead of paying them. Now, what we don't know is if there was some deal between Berman and Jackson where, because literally, dozens of songs that Mahalia Jackson's name was words and music by Mahalia Jackson that we know who they were actually written by. So that's one of the things I would love to learn more about, whether, and I don't know if we ever will, maybe it went to Berman and Jackson's grave with them, but how they thought through kind of making those decisions. But there is that, again, that tendency for Black songwriters to be obscured, especially gospel songwriters, to be obscured. And I think that's an important thing to emphasize, is how important these songwriters were in producing material for these singers, that this new style of gospel song pioneered by Thomas Dorsey, but also even earlier by people like Charles Henry Pace, who was in Chicago and later moved to Pittsburgh, Brewster and others. I think it's important to kind of acknowledge Lucy Campbell was another person, to acknowledge these people as being a cornerstone of the modern gospel movement.
Absolutely. And this tendency to glide over the contributions of individual African-American songwriters continues into the work of the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin in the 60s. I can remember Bobby Womack calling Keith Richards on the carpet for something that Mick Jagger had said about how, you know, we would come to America and then do these old, you know, dig up these old Black songs and do these old traditional blues numbers. And he's like, you know, MF-er, I'm younger than you are. Like, I'm sitting right here. I wrote this song, you know, and you know, they gave him his songwriting credits legally and everything, which Led Zeppelin was infamous for not doing. But yeah, like you said, this tendency to treat all Black cultural production as in some way communal, and therefore private property rights or intellectual property rights don't need to be respected. It's fascinating stuff.
I think it also pertains to Black voices too. I mean, I think, you know, you think about the sound on Stones records or other records of Black women's voices, you know, Joe Cocker's, you know, version of Get By With A Little Help With My Friends. I mean, the women's voices on that record, the Black women's voices are as prominent or in as much a part of the record as Cocker, and they're unacknowledged on the record. So just the that other kind of presence, which is not a songwriting presence, but is a sonic presence, that is so constitutive of the sound of that rock era, that doesn't get acknowledged. Maureen Mann's book Black Diamond Queens talks about this in a really interesting way, but that's another way in which the kind of influence and the impact on the music is obscured.
Absolutely, and that's a huge point. Like in the 70s, it seemed like, you know, after Leanne Russell and George Harrison got so big, it seemed like every touring rock act had two essentially anonymous Black girl singers on the stage. And this continues all the way up into the Talking Heads. I mean, the Talking Heads, you know, made a point of introducing them by name and everything, but it just became a trope that people were, you know, kind of accustomed to taking for granted. But I want to move on because you do some really fascinating analysis of the types of music in her Apollo era. And we in our previous episode, which is kind of an introduction to Mahalia, we talked about her Columbia period. So I was really kind of happy that you really zero in on the Apollo era. But you also talk about, you know, it's ironic, Mahalia Jackson, like, I think the first thing I learned about Mahalia was she was the only Black artist in my parents' record collection. And the second thing I learned about her was that she only sang religious songs. Like, I hadn't even heard any of the music. I just knew that she only sang religious songs. And yet you point out that certain songs, like this next one we're about to play, are not really, they're almost, they are as much pop as they are religious. And this is Mahalia Jackson's I Walked Into the Garden. And when we come back, you can explain the concept of the religious pop song.
Into the garden they call
was I Walked Into the Garden by Mahalia Jackson. And this is one of these artifacts from this early 50s era, the Mitch Miller era, the How Much Is That Doggy in the Window era, the Goodnight Irene and the Weavers era. But Joe Stafford and Gordon McRae had this song Whispering Hope on Capitol Records, I want to say in 1949. That was this massive, massive hit. And it's one of these hits that record men, looking back, and they were pretty much exclusively record men, except Bess Berman, I guess, wasn't. So record men and record women looked at this record and said, this is a big deal. This is a trend. Let's get on that. And you know, for Mahalia's first six sections with Apollo, there's no material like that, that she's doing Baptist hymns. She's doing traditional African-American spiritual. She's doing songs by this new generation of African-American gospel songwriters, but she's not doing anything you would call religious pop. But then in the final eight, that becomes not a dominant trend, but at least as big as any of the other ingredients. What happened there? And what was Mahalia's relationship to this material? I mean, she kind of vocally complained about it sometimes later on when she was at Columbia, but did she not see the same dichotomy between this and say doing blues or R&B?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought about it that way, that how she distinguished between sacred and secular music. I mean, it was religious themed music, and she religious theme was a very loose category for her. She could kind of make sometimes tortured arguments about what material was okay to sing and what material was off limits. But I think this gets back to what I said before about negotiating audiences. That part of the challenge that once she got signed by Apollo, and especially once she got signed by Columbia, that they're trying to find ways to expand her audience. And kind of from a Black church base to a kind of broader mainstream audience. So one way of navigating that was repertory. Now the historical context is important because this was the Cold War period, and the idea of American religiosity was a strong part of American identity that distinguished the United States from godless communism and the Soviet Union. So there is this explosion in the late 40s and early 50s of songs written trying to capture of religious pop, essentially. I Believe and songs like that that were incredibly popular. So in some ways, it's an effort for Mahalia to cross over. On the other hand, it's reflective of the broader climate of songs with religious flavor, which may have also created an environment where a religious singer was able to achieve the kind of visibility that she was able to achieve. Now, she later on kind of sang other songs for Columbia that were just, you know, what the world needs now is love, sweet love on TV. She would sing kind of any pop song that had love in it could be made to sound religious. With Leonard Feather, once the jazz critic said that, you know, even when she wasn't singing religious material, the way she sang it made it sound like it was religious. So she was always negotiating that, but I think Apollo Records was trying to both tap the popularity and the appeal of Mahalia Jackson and also the appeal of this kind of religious pop that could broaden the sales of her records.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the Cold War thing, because I think when you look at music in this post-war period, it's got to be seen through a lens of a mix of post-war PTSD and terror at the prospect of nuclear annihilation and communist infiltration / subversion. So Americans were very frightened in this period, and that's why the music went in this gentle, simple direction for several years. At the same time, while this sort of Pentecostal-powered R&B is bubbling under the surface, and, you know, it surfaces in Johnny Ray briefly, and then it's going to be, you know, exploding out with Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley and Little Richard and others later in the decade. But I want to get back to Mahalia's repertoire. And we talked about the religious pop songs that are not roughly a quarter, but it's one of four major strands in her repertoire. The other one is these gospel songs that, you know, from Brewster and Dorsey and Charles Tinley and Lucy Campbell et al. And there was still some pushback within the church. Occasionally people would say, you know, this woman's playing jazz in church, or she's bringing degrading rhythms into church, which when you really think about that is a really interesting statement, especially coming from an African-American to have internalized the racism of our country so deeply that African rhythms are now degrading rhythms that shouldn't be welcome in the church. How big of an issue was that for her into the 40s and 50s?
I think it became less of an issue once she became famous, quite honestly. And when I say famous, you know, Malcolm X once said that Mahalia Jackson was the first African American that Black people themselves made famous. In other words, the idea of fame is often associated, you cross over and once white audiences accept you, you're famous. But she was already famous when she crossed over, because Black America and her Black church base had embraced her so with such wild enthusiasm. So I think that what was the issue with Mahalia Jackson when she first started singing in Chicago, most people say, is less the repertory, because she was singing stuff straight out of Gospel Pearls, which was a kind of iconic songbook for Baptists. A lot of hymns came out of that. Then it was her performance style that people talked about, how her physical performance style, that that she was, there was a kind of almost a sexuality to her, her manner of performance, the way she moved. She didn't just stand with 2 feet in place and her body stationary and sing hymns, that she would throw her entire body into it. And so I think that was kind of tantalizing, but also kind of titillating in a more uncomfortable way for some church audiences, in terms of, you know, hiking up her robe when she sang and those sorts of things. So it's interesting, I think, repertory wise, other than the stuff she did for radio and the kind of religious pop, she was pretty, she really liked singing hymns and gospel songs. But her performance style, I think, really, her manner of performance, which again goes back to the Pentecostal influence, is what really kind of raised the eyebrows.
No doubt about that. And the next thing I want to hear it's something that's called Childhood Church Memories, in most recording presentations of it. But it's her singing, "Father, I Stretch My Hands to Thee," and introducing and discussing it, how she sang it in church and how they treated these traditional Baptist hymns in church. And it was recorded by a guy named William Bill Russell. And when we come back, I want you to introduce Bill Russell, who was he, and also talk about Mahalia's relationship to these Isaac Watts hymns and how they sang. This is Mahalia sharing her childhood church memories.
The name of the church was Mount Moriah Baptist Church. Well, it was a small church, very small, but it was spiritual. The type of people that went to that church, they wasn't ashamed to sing a song. They wasn't ashamed to testify to the glory of God. And you know, you could get such a warm feeling there. Everybody felt welcome. Little old church sat on the ground. Didn't even have a basement. Wasn't a great big church here like New York.
Father, I stretch my hand to thee.
And that was Mahalia Jackson explaining to Bill Russell how she sang traditional hymns like "Father, I Stretch My Hands to Thee" in church when she was growing up. Explain who Bill Russell was. Like, how did an aspiring avant-garde composer come to be one of the most important chroniclers of Mahalia Jackson's life?
Well, he's such an interesting figure, and in between kind of his desire to be a composer, and he had connections. He studied with Arnold Schoenberg at UCLA, and he collaborated with John Cage and was writing quite experimental music, trying to incorporate jazz, which was an interest of his, into the music. But really what Russell's claim to fame is that he was the preeminent expert on New Orleans jazz, and particularly early New Orleans jazz, he contributed to a collection called Jazzmen, which was one of the first kind of studies of jazz, wrote the section on New Orleans jazz. So he was considered this guru who knew all about, and eventually knew personally, a lot of these early New Orleans jazz musicians. So he was obsessed with kind of Bunk Johnson, for instance, the trumpeter. He followed around and kind of helped resuscitate his career and kind of recorded him later in life after he had kind of dropped off the radar screen a little bit. So within the jazz world, Bill Russell was kind of this luminary. What's interesting is that he heard Mahalia Jackson on the radio at a Johnny Myers show and fell in love with her voice. Part of it may have been the fact that she, obviously her voice, but also the fact that she herself was a New Orleanian. So that's another connection he may have had to her. But eventually he moved to Chicago, and in Chicago, he tracked down Mahalia Jackson and started going to her gospel programs, and eventually became essentially a personal assistant. And what's funny is that Jackson had no idea who he was, you know, so other people knew, oh my goodness, the New Orleans jazz expert, Bill Russell. But she just knew him as Bill, the guy she told to, you know, fix her pipes and, you know, change light bulbs and water her plants and make her posters and put up posters and make her cue cards for the studio. And he has a remarkable record. He basically kept a journal for 3 years, a day-by-day journal of working with Mahalia Jackson, of everything he did with her. So it's one of the most remarkable records of any musician you'll ever find, because it's so detailed. He's describing all these church programs. But he also, I think, important role for him is that he helped facilitate her crossover from Apollo to Columbia, because he knew George Avakian and Mitch Miller and the producers at Columbia, so he can kind of speak their language, but he also knew Mahalia, so he could speak to her as well and helped rehearse with her, recorded her rehearsals, which is an incredible document as well that's in the archives. So he was actually a really unsung but incredibly important figure in helping Mahalia Jackson navigate this transition from a small independent label to to the biggest record company in the world.
Yeah, it was really fascinating when he came across, you know, when we come across him in the narrative in your book. I was not expecting the connection to the avant-garde, nor was I expecting this connection to the whole trad jazz versus, you know, bebop controversy, which was a big, big thing in this period. And people like Russell, perhaps unfairly, sometimes were called moldy figs, et cetera, and seen as enemies of the new music. But it's just fascinating how much everything is connected in this very small world we share. And the last thing I want to talk about is her approach to the music of Isaac Watts, and also this influence of you know, Puritan English songwriters like Isaac Watts on African American gospel music. Pulled some of that apart. Like, how big a part of the mix was the work of Isaac Watts, and how did a singer like Mahalia Jackson approach this stuff rhythmically? Because you also cross analyze these things in terms of, you know, if it's got a bounce rhythm or a gospel feel or a swing feel, and the songs that came from these hymns, she tended to sing in a what you call a free feel. Explain that.
One of the traditions in Baptist churches, Black Baptist churches, although you also encounter them in white primitive Baptist churches as well too, is what's known as lined out hymn singing. So this is a practice that was designed for congregations where musical literacy or literacy period was limited. So you'd have a song leader who sang a line and then the group would sing a line back, but in this very elaborate kind of sinuous way. The kind of fancy musical term is melismatic, which just basically means you sing a lot of notes on each syllable. And it had this kind of free feel in the sense of there was no meter, there's no beat, but it just kind of, and it's amazing to hear, because it sounds like the congregation is just kind of oozing forward on these long lines. So I think you hear a lot of that practice in Mahalia Jackson's performances of hymns. Baptists often approach singing hymns with this kind of very slow, deliberate kind of style where you can kind of hear the meter, but it just feels like it's kind of unfolding in a kind of free. You may have heard when people sing Amazing Grace, they often sing it in that very kind of free style. When Obama sang Amazing Grace after the shooting in South Carolina, he sang it in that style too. So Amazing Grace is one of those hymns. So these, it's interesting that the texts of those lined out hymns come from these English hymn writers like Isaac Watts, these 18th century hymn writers, but they're adapted in these Black Baptist churches in this style that I think shows up in this free Baptist hymn approach, that which is one of three approaches that I kind of talk about, the others being a kind of much more faster tempoed swing feel, where you have kind of four beats that has this kind of this ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. She sometimes referred to it as a kind of bounce feel, songs with a bounce that she can sing and use a little bit more rhythmic energy. And then a kind of in between what I call a gospel feel, which involves a kind of back and forth between Jackson and the accompanist plays a key role, where they kind of, there's a division of labor between the singer and the accompanist, that this back and forth that I kind of describe as the gospel seesaw. And it's a, but these three very distinct feels, and I was surprised at how much of her music, almost all of her recordings outside of the religious pop songs, kind of fell into those categories. So it's interesting, we talk about Black gospel, but there is a diversity of approaches even within that category during this period of Jackson's career.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up the accompaniment, because I really want to give a shout out to Mildred Falls, the pianist, and Blind Francis, the organist. And that combination of piano and organ becomes synonymous with gospel music, such that when Ray Charles, you know, invents soul / rewrites gospel songs as R&B hits pretty blatantly too. I got to mention Ray, because, you know, the conversation we were having earlier about publishing rights, he trespassed as much as anybody. But, you know, when Bob Dylan goes to Nashville and his big blonde on blonde period, and he has a piano and an organist, it's very clearly a nod and an attempt to draw on this power of gospel music. And then it becomes a staple of early 70s and 70s hard rock in general. How did that particular accompaniment combination come together in the studio for her? And was that just a replication of what they had been doing in the churches?
Yeah, I mean, Falls definitely was her regular accompanist. That whenever she's really a remarkable figure. And again, one of those people that you wish you knew more about. She was Jackson's accompanist for about 25 years, and she fished around for a regular pianist on the early recordings. There's a few different pianists until she settles on Falls, and then Falls is with her through the duration of the Apollo period and a lot of the Columbia period as well too. So whenever she would go to church events, you know, whenever she had to perform, she would just, Mildred, let's go, and Falls would be there. For the Columbia recordings, she was paired. It's very typical for a pianist and or a piano and organ together to be accompany a gospel performance. The organ's useful because it can sustain tones. So when you're singing in that kind of free feel, you can kind of just hold notes as long as you need to until you you move ahead with the singer. But I think Columbia tried to capture some. You definitely hear that on the Apollo recordings, and this very, and, you know, they also are singing with backup singers. They're singing with guitarists. There's a saxophone on one scandalous record in the view of some.
That's right.
But at Columbia, they kind of the Falls, and Ralph Jones was the organist. So they called it the Falls Jones Ensemble, which just basically meant Mildred Falls and Ralph Jones, but paired with other musicians as well too. So she was really Mildred Falls, a real regular component of Jackson's sound, and developed an incredible sensitivity to Jackson's kind of improvisatory flights in performance on recordings and in live settings.
And when you bring up improvisatory, I'm going to improvise a question. I kind of surprised you with something I hadn't thrown at you in any of the notes or anything. And that's, I kind of see Mahalia Jackson and Ella Fitzgerald as sisters, both kind of musical daughters of Bessie Smith, who obviously went in very different directions, you know, one being the queen of gospel and the other being, you know, first one of the queens of swing and then one of the great bebop and jazz interpretive singers. Is there any record of Mahalia talking about Ella Fitzgerald other than she sings blues and I don't? What do they think of each other? Do we have any idea?
I don't. The only mention of Ella Fitzgerald that I can think of off the top of my head that Mahalia Jackson had was they sang on the same program together. The Pittsburgh Courier had a contest basically for top singers in all kinds of categories. So blues categories, jazz categories, gospel categories, and then the winners would all perform on a big concert together. So in this particular year, I can't remember what year it was, I think it was 1953 actually, in Detroit, where they had the culminating concert. And Jackson sang on that program, and Ella Fitzgerald also sang on that program. And the only thing she said was, according to Bill Russell, who is of course there documenting everything, Russell felt that Ella Fitzgerald hadn't sung very well and was not received very well, but Maley Jackson was received rapturously. And Jackson just said, well, you know, sometimes they, I think she's something, they like singers with big voices, or, you know, because Ella Fitzgerald had a much more delicate, she wasn't a belter like Mahalia Jackson could be. So she was aware of Ella's particular voice. And that, I think that's really telling. This goes way back to what I was saying before about her attention to sound, that she really studied other singers a lot. She watched a lot of TV, and she loved watching variety shows with singers. And she, Russell records just her, almost just kind of her data entry about the various singers she's hearing. So she was very aware of other singers. So I'm sure she had views on Ella Fitzgerald's voice. I don't know if Ella Fitzgerald ever said anything about Hillary Jackson. Sarah Vaughan did express that she wanted to have the kind of emotional impact of Mahalia Jackson's voice, but not so sure about Ella Fitzgerald.
Well, fascinating stuff. And my guest has been Mark Burford, and the book is Mahalia Jackson and the Black Gospel Field. Highly recommended. If you like Let It Roll, this is the most Let It Roll book I've come across in years. Mark, thanks so much for writing it, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks very much, Nate. I appreciate it. Enjoyed talking to you.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate and new Let It Roll intern Ivan DeHaas kick off a new series, Three Kings of Emo Rap, with a look at XXXTentacion's documentary, Look at Me. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.